For the week of July 6th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 243, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
Allentown, Pennsylvania, are you visiting Billy Joel by any chance?
He's not here.
Okay.
He's in residence at Madison Square Garden. I'm visiting my brother.
Okay.
And I have my mic, and I have a sock on my mic, and it's a white sock I'm going to use when I defeat him in tennis later today.
Okay, I just would like to know, is white sock and mic, are these euphemisms for something?
No, a lot of people put a sock over their mic to stop the popping of the peas.
Ah, okay. Wow. Okay, well, and I just dated myself, by the way, by asking whether you were hanging out with Billy Joel in Allentown, because
it's a classic song.
It's a classic song from the early 1980s.
By the way, do I interrupt you too much? Because I thought that was our thing. I thought, you know, you tried to speak and I interrupt. It's like Abbott and Costello, or Laurel and Hardy. But apparently, it's not our thing. I'm just annoying.
Okay, I don't know where that came from.
Someone told me I interrupt you too much.
You know what?
I just did it again.
It's been noted by not only a few listeners, but a few radio station producers as well. Yes.
Ouch.
But hey, you know what? We never said we were professional, people. If we were professional, we would be on Twitter getting fired.
I thought it was our thing. Exactly. Before we get to the stuff we're going to talk about on today's show, we got some obituaries. Director Paul Mazursky died, a great, not a great director, but a major director, made a lot of films. And if you want to celebrate his life, watch one of his good films like Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice or Harry and Tonto. And my favorite, which is Enemies, A Love Story, a very good film. And I would say the best adaptation of an Isaac Bashevis Singer story that we've had so far.
Yeah, you know, when I was in film school, he was directing a film called The Pickle, and it was
one of his lesser films.
Yes, and a film that he would openly mock himself, as a matter of fact. apparently, he was quite funny, and when something went wrong, and, you know, when a film wasn't good, he would be the first to say, how many jokes could I tell about how bad this movie was? and he shot this whole movie in Washington Square Park outside my window, and I would see him come to work every day and sit in his little chair next to at that time, the monitor, you know, this big giant CRT screen that he would watch all the takes in. And at the time, I thought, wow, he's really old. And that was like 25 years ago.
Well, also dying this week, who was quite young, was Paul Apted, the son of director Michael Apted. Paul was a well-known sound editor, a very successful in his own right. He did sound editing on films like The Fault in Our Stars, which is a big hit in theaters right now, and Prisoners. He died of colon cancer at 47. So, you know, if that runs in your family, for heaven's sakes, get a checkup. And one other person, too, also died.
Louis Zamperini. And, you know, he may not be known to everybody, but he was... I like the way some of his obituaries read, juvenile delinquent track star, Olympian, war hero.
That's right. He's the basis. He's the center of a book called Unbroken by author Laura Hillenbrand, who had a big success story with Seabiscuit, and then this novel, this book, which was a huge bestseller. And, of course, Angelina Jolie has turned it into a film, and it comes out this fall. I don't want to say he's promoting the film, but it's one of those things where just as the film is coming close to coming out, you know, you gain a whole bunch of press publicity by the death of this man who's like 94 years old. God bless him.
He was
like that.
No, he was 97. Just to give you some sense of how old he was, and this isn't a joke. I mean, he lived around the corner from me when I lived in the Hollywood Hills.
How does everybody live around the corner from you in LA?
I did not realize this, actually. I had seen him. Somebody told me, oh, that's Louis Zamperini. This was like 15, 20 years ago. No, it was 15 years ago. And I thought, okay, that's great. Who the heck is Louis Zamperini? And, you know, they explained it to me. So when he passed away, I thought, okay, how close did he really live to me? Because I would see him walking every once in a while, you know, maybe once, twice, three times a year. And so I looked up his address in Hollywood, in the Hollywood Hills, and sure enough, it was around the corner from me. The house he lived in was built in 1922, and it's now worth between $2.5 and $3.5 million. And to show you how messed up California is as a state, he paid $1,700 in tax last year for property taxes, which is... For that property.
Well, how did we get into real estate? The man just died.
I know. I'm just
what
saying.
What the heck? He led a good, full life. He's a man of faith, a preacher. He's told a story to people around the country, overcame massive adversity in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And, you know, God bless him. I mean, it's sad that a sympathy go to his family, but, you know, he's 97 years old, lived a good full life.
And by the way, for all of those people who say Michael interrupts me, that's why he interrupts me. Otherwise, we go down these tributaries of property taxes.
So our thoughts go out to his family and all the people who knew him and Paul Apted and Mazursky. But let's move on to the show. What will we be talking about this week?
Well, on this week's show, we'll be talking to Jonathan Handel. He's been on the show before. He's an entertainment attorney with Troy Gould and a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. He will join us during Inside Baseball to discuss the new 3-year contract deal. I like the, you know, how many adjectives can I use there? It's a 3-year contract deal that SAG-AFTRA reached with producers and studios. It's kind of a, no pun intended, it is kind of a big deal because now there won't be a strike. Nielsen has released music sales figures for the first half of 2014. Now you gave away the surprise ending. As more and more consumers turn to streaming services, sales of albums and individual tracks have noticeably declined, as Michael just kind of told you. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And by the way, I'm going to ruin your surprise, Michael. Down. They're all down.
That's because nothing opened up this weekend very much, but Tammy opened up, I guess. But the number one movie around the world, and we're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. We get our figures from Rent Track. We got a link to their website in our show notes. We also pull info from Hollywood Reporter, Variety, everywhere else that we can. The number one movie, just like last weekend, is Transformers Age of Extinction. It grossed $132 million worldwide. It's at just under $600 million total and counting. And guess what? That does not include most of Europe or most of Central and South America because World Cup is on. So this movie has a huge way to go. I think it's going to hit $1 billion. It's certainly going to blow past $800 million.
Well, I wonder, very successful. I wonder, and not to interrupt you, but I do wonder, actually, I think that it, for the most part, we all know that the movie wasn't very good because the reviews
were dreadful.
It's dreadful. The Twitters and the Facebooks, they're all telling us it's dreadful. The critics are all telling us it's dreadful. And so I wonder if, like Iron Man 3, which, okay, happened to be a good movie, but still.
No, it's not that good a movie. It was slightly better than Iron Man 2, but it still wasn't as good as Iron Man 1.
Well, that's true, which I didn't think was such a great movie in the first place. But anyway.
None of them were on our best of the year list, as none of the Transformers films would be.
Correct. But I wonder if by opening day and date around the world, the way Iron Man 3 did, it went on
but
to.
But they didn't.
Right. I'm saying Iron Man 3 did.
Oh.
It went on to make all this money, $1 billion, I think $1.2 billion and maybe even more. I wonder if by delaying the opening in those territories, they will actually make less money because of word of mouth or poor word of mouth.
But the fans don't care. They don't hate the movie.
That's true. So maybe not.
Yeah, it's not a movie where like people say, uh-oh, we want to stay away from. Fans are happy with it. It is doing less well in North America. It's only at about $175 million. But internationally, it's made $400 million.
And I would say a large chunk of that comes from a little tiny country named China.
Well, not a large chunk, but a big chunk, like $100 million, right?
I think it might even be more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it made $90 million last weekend, right? So I don't know what it made this weekend, but probably $30 million, $40 million, I don't know.
I don't know, but it's supposedly going to be the top-grossing American film in China.
It already is. It's the top-grossing film of all time. It's passing Titanic, they say.
And Avatar.
I mean, Avatar, yeah. So yeah, it's a big, big hit, and we still don't know who went to see it in 3D. We know in Russia, everybody saw it in 3D, but for the rest of the world, not a peep. So I'm going to guess way, way down. Nobody cared. I know somebody who went to see it in 3D, but I'm going to guess it had to be well under normal. It clearly was not any number they wanted to talk about. So I think it's another example of 3D being on the, it's not going to ever go away any more than black and white will go away. Some films will be shot in black and white. Some films will be shown in 3D, like the next Avatar movies. But I think it's really in its death throes.
Well, $218 million it needs to make in China to surpass Avatar. So I think it's very close to surpassing that by midweek, they say it will be. So it's close to $200 million just in China, which means, of course, Paramount will be able to take home a good $2 to $3 million.
$50 million.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. The more you make there, the more you want to hold off and fight them over how much money they're getting out of the country.
That's true.
At number two around the world is How to Train Your Dragon 2. A bit of a disappointment. The animated film has made $42 million this weekend, and it's at almost $300 million worldwide. Not quite keeping pace with the first one, But we'll see where it ends up.
You know, I'll tell you, DreamWorks Animation cannot catch a break.
Yeah, it got good reviews. You know, it's a decent movie. It's going to make money, but it's not a big, big hit.
No, and it is a good movie.
I haven't seen it yet. At number three, not a good movie, is Tammy, the Melissa McCarthy vehicle. It grossed $23 million. It's at $35 million and counting. I guess it opened up on Wednesday?
I think on Tuesday it opened up. Tuesday night,
that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It made just a little bit money overseas. I'm not sure what kind of a draw she is yet overseas. I don't know if you know.
I don't know at all whether, I mean, as Dan...
Some of her movies have made money, obviously, overseas.
Yeah, but. I know you're going to get into this in a minute, but I was surprised by some of the things that were said by Warner Brothers.
Yeah, they really messed that up. At number four is Maleficent, the Angelina Jolie movie. She's having a career year here. Another $23 million for that retelling of a fairy tale. Not animated at all. It's live action.
That is the top grossing non-action hero movie. It's made $600 million. It's the
first...
Well,
why make that distinction?
Because all of the other...
That's a studio, but that's such a dumb distinction. It's a top-grossing comedy with a female lead. It's like, whatever.
Well, if you're
it's
trying...
It's the second highest-grossing film of the year. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is, if you're in the business of making these big blockbusters and you're looking at what's making all the money, and you look at four or five films, all of which are based on superheroes they're all based on superheroes, and they've all made over $400 million, and then you get to Maleficent, you say, okay, so only one has been... One non-superhero movie has been able to cross the $400 or $500 million mark.
You're talking worldwide or what?
Worldwide, yes.
Right. It's I believe number one is X-Men. Number two is Captain America. Transformers will pass them by very soon. Maleficent is number three for the year.
Okay.
Right? Those were made over $700 million, and Maleficent is at $630 million. So I think I'm certain X-Men and Captain America are ahead of it. Those are both
The Amazing Spider-Man. Is ahead of it.
Oh, that's also ahead of it, too. That's also in the $700 million range, even though it's the lowest grossing in the Spider-Man franchise.
Yes, and they're all,
So it's number four.
It's number four. Right. Worldwide.
Okay. Well, I mean, why not say that? What's wrong? You know, all those slicing and dicing to me is just pointless.
Well, I mean, if you're a studio executive, you know, you look at
these
things.
You take comfort in slicing and dicing things and pretending it means something.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah.
And number five is 22 Jump Street. The modestly budgeted R-rated comedy, another $20 million. It's at $230 million worldwide. And number six, a big hit in China, is The Breakup Guru. I think it's in a few other small territories right around there. It's made $17 million this weekend, and it's at $65 million and counting. I don't know if this is akin to the plot that I had described back a week or two ago, but this is a big success story, a big successful romantic comedy in China. We'll have to see where it ends up, but my God, $65 million in one country. See how far it can cross over into Asia and perhaps the rest of the world. And number seven is The Fault in Our Stars, another $12 million. That's what it costs to make. So it made back its budget this weekend, and then worldwide it's at $220 million. And number eight, Tom Cruise is still clawing to profitability with Edge of Tomorrow, another $12 million. That's at $340 million. I don't know if there are any big territories left for that one.
I don't know, but I would say, again, I urge people to see this movie. It is worth seeing. It's a good movie.
It's the Sperling Reich stamp of approval. I saw Snowpiercer. I thought it was fun. I didn't love it. It wasn't as good as I hoped. It wasn't nearly as good as The Host, but it was fun and definitely had a certain surreal Brazil quality to it. There was some fun acting in it. It was a little nutty. I don't think it's a hugely wide commercial type movie, but certainly people who like offbeat films like Brazil, I think, might find it worth their time.
And we're not talking about Brazil, the country. We're talking about Brazil, the Terry Gilliam film.
No, Brazil, the country is fine. I'm rooting for them against Germany. Sorry,
okay.
Germany.
Okay.
It's fun to see the host country do well, I think. At number nine is Deliver Us from Evil, another $12 million. This is the opening weekend for this horror film. It's at $17 million total, most of that in North America. Mixed reviews, I would say, for this horror flick, sort of a cop/horror film. It's kind of a not good reviews, kind of a lame film, but there's some good actors in it. At number 10 is The Divine Move, which I kept reading as The Divine Movie, but that's not it at all. It's The Divine Move. It's a South Korean film, sort of a noirish action adventure film. It's about a guy who's great at Go, the board game Go. That's what we call it. In South Korea, it's known as Baeduk. Baeduk or Baeduk?
I don't know. Don't take your South Korean pronunciation from me. That's a bad move.
We don't know. You know, the board game Go is that board game that we know, and it's called Baeduk or Baeduk. In South Korea, and this guy's a great Go player, and I think The Divine Move is kind of like checkmate. You know, it's like the other guy can't go anymore and you've won. It's this great final move that means you win the game. And what happens is this guy is defeated by the bad guy and he's framed for his brother's murder. I mean, that's really rude. And so he gets sent to jail and then he vows revenge and he pairs himself with a blind master of Go and they train him and he goes back and he ends up having to face off against the guy in one final match of Go. So if it's a big hit, I'm sure Go will sweep the nation here in North America.
I'm wondering, is this a comedy? Because it sounds very funny.
It's a serious film.
I know, I understand that, but it does sound like it could be a comedy.
If you don't want to rent E.T., you might have gone to see Earth to Echo this weekend. That's the family-friendly film that rips off the plot of E.T. It made $8 million. It's at $13 million and counting. They paid $12 million, I think, to buy the movie and then reshoot it. I think Disney put it into turnaround. And so... who's it's not Mulan. Who is it?
Relativity.
Relativity is the distributor of that. So they claim they're going to make money when all is said and done. And I should have said that about a Tammy, but we'll get to that in a minute. Jersey Boys is at $43 million worldwide. X-Men, Days of Future Past, and so on are still bringing in some money around the world. A couple of films that aren't quite on the list. Mrs. Brown's Boys, that's the Gaelic version of Medea. That's now at $15 million in that country. And there was a wide release for the documentary film America by Dinesh D'Souza, whose movies do not get good reviews by almost any critics, even liberal or conservative, though the right wing likes his movies. This one says America's great. That's basically what the documentary is about. And those stupid liberals say America's horrible and a force of evil. And we say, no, America's wonderful. So I don't know who's running around saying America's terrible.
Well, you know, this got the Rush Limbaugh stamp of approval. And I wonder if that's going to become the like Oprah Winfrey stamp of approval.
Well, see, now some people would say the movie's a flop, right? It opened wide and it grossed $2.7 million. That's mean it's made a total of $4 million in North America, right? Now, his last film, 2016 Obama's America, was wildly successful. That grossed $33 million.
And these are documentaries, and granted, some might say propaganda-ish documentaries.
No, all documentaries are propaganda-ish, you know, are they balanced, are they accurate, whatever, but documentaries tell a story or are based on nonfiction things, but it grossed $33 million. That's a ton of money. One of the highest grossing documentary films of all time. So compared to that, America looks weak, but you know what? $4 million is a lot of money.
Yes, especially for a documentary.
It makes it one of the highest, only for a documentary. It's not a lot of money for a blockbuster $200 million movie, but for a documentary, that's a lot of money. However, 2016 cost $2.5 million to make. That's actually a lot of money for a documentary. And because that movie made a lot of money, I'm betting they were foolish and they maybe spent $3 million on this one. I have no reason. I tried to look up. I tried to find out what the budget might be. I can't find out anywhere. Maybe they were smart and they only spent $500,000 on it. I don't know. But $2.5 million would already mean they're still in the red, though they would likely hopefully get to profitability. But I'm going to guess because that one was such a big hit, they probably spent more money on this one, maybe $3 million. So they may be that much farther away from profitability. And that's really the judge of a movie.
Well, do you think Tammy, this film with Melissa McCarthy, will actually break even or make money? I think it probably will.
Absolutely, right? It costs like $23 million to make or something like that, right? It was a $20 million movie. And so it's already at what, $35 million worldwide?
Yeah. And so what I would say is,
I mean, that's a hit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people say, oh, it didn't do nearly as well as her last film. Oh, it's a flop. It's like, well, but she made it for the right price. It's making money. There you go. Now, it was directed by her husband, right?
Yes.
Right. It was directed by her husband. It was their project. They wanted to make it happen. Susan Sarandon is in a supporting role, but it's right in line with her other movies. It's not like she made a movie about nuns and, you know, it was quiet and contemplative. It was still a broad comedy. It got terrible reviews, but that happens. But yeah, I know why you're bringing this up. It's because the Warner Brothers head of distribution, Dan Fellman, had an awkward quote in The Hollywood Reporter about this movie. When they asked him about the box office, he said, quote, "There's nothing wrong here. It's true that tracking was more favorable for us going into the weekend, but this was a $20 million movie. This is a movie Melissa did by herself with her husband. It doesn't have a big supporting star like Sandy," meaning Sandra Bullock, who was in The Heat. That was his quote. There's like 18 things wrong in that one little paragraph.
Well, can you tell that Dan Fellman is retiring this year?
Oh, is he?
I think he's either this year or next year, yeah.
Oh, okay. So he's just speaking it like it is. Because this is a movie Melissa did all by herself with her husband.
Really? Like, you didn't have anything to do with it?
Yeah, it makes it sound like this home movie, like their own little cutesy little project, you know? Like, no, you should say this is a passion project for her and her husband, you know, that she was really supportive of, and her fans flocked out to see it. It's going to make us money, and we're very proud to be associated with it and Melissa. Instead, he's like, oh, that little thing? It didn't have a big star in it like Sandra Bullock. Oh, thank you, Susan Sarandon. I'm sure she appreciates being treated as a nothing add-on to the film. It was just like... I didn't know he was retiring. That explains all.
I was waiting for you to get to the story just so that I could say that, because I knew that you would awesome. Like that little tidbit.
Yes, that's awesome. And one final movie that's way down on the worldwide charts and made a couple million dollars is Bunshin Saba 3.
And this I would say Gesundheit.
This is a horror film in China. It's the third in a series. The first one made $9 million. The second one made $13 million. So we'll have to see where this one ends up. But it's by a South Korean director called An Byung-ki. Again, my apologies. Or Byung-ki. I don't know how to pronounce that. But this is a South Korean director who has set up shop in mainland China, which is really unusual, if not unprecedented. So that's kind of an interesting little thing. And that series has been successful for him. But that movie opened up in China as well. So not every movie in China makes, you know, $50 million, $100 million. But, you know, there's a lot of activity going on there.
Well, certainly no movie in Germany is making that much money.
Yeah, that's right. Box office dropped in Germany, like it seems to be all over the world, except China.
Well, and it's not just the World Cup. It's basically they just didn't have good films in the first half of this year. So the first half of this year, The Wolf of Wall Street was the highest grossing film in Germany. And I guess the gross receipts for the 6 months of 2014, they slipped in Germany alone. And the reason we're mentioning this is it just gives you some perspective here. $626 million is how much that territory earned, no matter who was releasing the film, whether it was a German film or an English film or a French film. $626 million, the highest grossing film, The Wolf of Wall Street. It's down 8%.
It's down about $45 million.
Right.
Okay.
And box office, of course, is we could go into the North American box office, how it's down and blah, 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 blah. But, you know.
This summer is down compared to last summer. It's about $500 million short from where we were last year for the summer season.
Well, if you look at the fact that over the 4th of July last year, you had Despicable Me 2 earning, you know, boatloads of money, close to, I think, it was $100 million or more. So there's, you know, 25% of your 20% of your missing money right there.
Well, 4th of July fell on a Friday this year, and that messed up the box office. It wasn't a good year for 4th of July, though even the last time 4th of July fell on a Friday, the weekend still was down compared to the last time that happened. No, there's been no big hit in North America. No movie has topped $300 million during the summer, and this is the first time since 2001 that that's happened. I would say, on the other hand, they're making movies year-round. Summer doesn't start in the summer. It starts in early May now. And you had Captain America. That came out in April, right? You had the Lego movie. That came out in February. Those made about $250 million in North America. Captain America is at $700 million worldwide. You got a lot of small films that have done well, like The Fault in Our Stars, Neighbors, 22 Jump Street, the Kevin Hart movies, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and all the Christian films, Heaven is for Real, God's Not Dead, Son of God. That's a TV movie repeat. So this summer did not have big hits, but it didn't have a lot of embarrassing flops either.
You know,
no movie
as
has sent people running for the exits.
You know, as you've been talking, I was trying to remember, did I see Captain America 2? I think I did see Captain America 2.
Yeah, and, I did. It was good.
And this whole kind of, you know, internal monologue has been going on with me trying to remember even a single frame of Captain America 2.
I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was better than the first one, and I thought it was better than most of the other summer movies.
Yes, no, and you know, it took me a while, but yes, I do remember seeing it, and yes, it was better than the first
one. But the point is, you know, we're locked into comparing summer to summer, and I think the whole year is more likely, and then wait till the year's over, because your hits can now come in February. They can come in September rather than November. You know, it doesn't matter when the hits come, as long as they come. And we'll see where we are the year over. And let's remember, last year was the highest grossing summer of all time. We should expect to be down from last year. Every year is not going to set a record.
What I would say is everybody is saying, oh, this year the World Cup has really taken off in the U.S.
Well, yeah, and it's been 4 years. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so people are off watching the World Cup. You know what? You can't have, you know, everybody start paying attention to the World Cup finally, and you know, you've been waiting, what, 50 years for that to happen? And
right.
Then also complain that people aren't going to the movie theater.
Well, they can't go to the movies as well.
They
can. And
you
can have good counter programming. And you know what? I think they're way underreporting World Cup ratings. I don't think there's any question about it. For me, you see the record ratings like the quarterfinal match between Brazil and Germany. No, I'm sorry, but Brazil and Germany is on Tuesday.
Brazil and Colombia.
That like 6 million people watched it on ESPN, and that was a record, you know, for that point in the World Cup. But I'm sorry, it was a lot more people than that. And you look at the U.S. matches. You've seen thousands of people gathered in public. It was unbelievable. That to me defines World Cup. That you want to be in a public place with a lot of other people. You're not happy watching it at home. People will watch the Super Bowl at home. They'll watch the World Series at home. World Cup means you go out and you watch it with a bunch of other people. And that's exactly where it's so hard to track how many people are actually watching. There wasn't a bar in New York City that was not jammed with people during the day. People were out of work. You couldn't move in these bars. And I'm talking, we went to five places before we found a place where we could squeeze in to watch that last match. I mean, it's kind of fun.
Well, and, you know, they were in the afternoon on the East Coast. They were in the morning on the West Coast, and there were pubs opening up. I watched it here at home and, you know, scared the dog every time, you know, the U.S. nearly scored. And, the dog does not like World Cup soccer, apparently.
Yeah, so, and that definitely, I mean, just like the Olympics, that will depress movie going. You know, people are all caught up and obsessed with that. So, of course, every 4 years, that's a big effect. But I think overall the year, we'll see where we end up. The nice thing is there are no big flops, so nobody has to lose their job. And while there's no huge success stories in North America, worldwide box office is so big. We got three movies that are over $700 million, with the fourth and the fifth one about to arrive any minute now, thanks to Transformers and Maleficent.
Yeah, so what are we complaining about, for Pete's sake?
Right, movie ticket sales are fine, but what about music?
Well, you know, I guess technically you could say music sales could be better. Nielsen SoundScan, which is the group that does all the numbers and the figures and all the tracking and with the music and the movie. Well, I guess they don't do movies so much, but they do television and they do music. And they released their numbers for the first half of 2014 U.S. music sales and airplay and streaming data, and they compile all this data, and they said, you know, actually, sales of albums are down about 14.9% versus, you know, the 6 months of 2013. Vinyl album sales and on-demand streaming continue to show improvement.
Thank you, Jack White.
Yeah, vinyl sales are up 40%, so I guess five people have purchased albums now. On-demand streaming is up by 42% over the same period from 2013.
What do they mean up 42%? Do they mean in viewership? Do they mean gross dollar amounts? What are they talking about?
I would imagine that is airplay. So I would imagine that's not dollar amounts, since they can't track that necessarily.
Well, that's nice, since they only charge a hundredth of a penny for every track.
Exactly.
You know, it could be up 800%, but it still doesn't mean people are making money.
Yeah, 70 billion songs are now available for streaming. Can you believe that? I mean, what are some of these songs? 70 billion songs?
70 billion?
I didn't know that 70 billion songs had actually been written.
That doesn't sound right.
Hey.
Who came up with 70 billion?
Nielsen.
Well, an average of 10 tracks an album, which is probably low in this day and age, but you could even say 20. I mean, how many albums is that?
I have no idea.
70, I mean, that's 10 billion albums? There aren't 10 billion albums in the world. That doesn't sound right. You know, they may be duplicating, or, you know, I mean, like the Beatles release an album, then they have a remastered version, then they have a box set with the same album. Maybe that's how they're counting them multiple times or something. Because
yes,
that, you know, Elvis has you know 8,000 albums, but they're all, like, a lot of them are the same 40 songs over and over again. That must be what's happening, because there's no way there's 10 billion albums that have been recorded in history. That's too high.
Well, and I see here the sale of individual tracks and digital formats fell. Declining by 133%.
That's a bad sign.
Yeah, that, because, you know, this is basically singles. So
yeah, and digital album sales, I'm sure, are not exploding either. Oh my God, only five albums have gone gold in North America. That means they've sold 500,000 copies or more. Only one album, the Frozen soundtrack, only one album has gone platinum, which means they've sold 1 million copies. That is pathetic. Oh my God, nobody is buying music anymore. Nothing could illustrate that to me more. There's no multi-platinum album. Only one album has gone platinum. That is unbelievable.
Well, I have to say, you know, I used to buy a lot of music, and I believe that a number of factors are at play with me. One, I am old. I am really old, and I know I'm not
there's
like 90.
Still good music to listen to.
I'm not Lou Zamperini old, but I, you know, I don't make it to the record store. Granted,
and we can't run like him.
I certainly can't run like him. But
well, that's the, you said you can't make it
I
to
knew
the record
you were
store.
We're going to pick up on that, but no, I know there aren't any record stores anymore. But
very few. But you've got Amoeba at least. You can go somewhere. I've got virtually nowhere.
Yeah, and I think really what it is that I can just listen to everything on Spotify. Anything I want
to
listen to is there.
Is it always available? Every song you can want to look up?
Almost always. I mean, wow. The Black Keys, no. They're not available on Spotify.
Did you buy their album?
Yes, I did.
Well, it worked.
But I would have bought the Black Keys even if I could listen to it on Spotify. I would have bought the Black Keys anyway.
You're that kind of fan.
Yes, so just like any U2 album I'll buy, you know, same thing. Any Elvis Costello album I'll buy.
You are old. Wow. Yes. So do you listen to stuff on SoundCloud?
I do listen to stuff on SoundCloud, actually. Yes.
In what context? The only time I go to SoundCloud is when a label or somebody says, oh, our artist has a new single up or available to listen or it's ready, and I'll go check out a song because they send me the link. I don't actually go there and look stuff up. I would always go to YouTube first.
Well, now, you know, actually, that the way I was introduced to SoundCloud was that musicians would send you their tracks via SoundCloud, but it's kind of become this kind of catch-all for all of this audio distribution. And, you know, people keep telling me we should put Showbiz Sandbox on SoundCloud. But my fear is that if we put, you know, 243 episodes at once on SoundCloud, it will look like we did 243 episodes in July of 2014 when we've been doing this since 2009.
Well, they're dated A and B. Perhaps you could just start with one.
Okay. And work
backwards. Are there people who don't get it that they would want it via SoundCloud because that was more convenient for them than other sources? Or what's the idea?
I don't know. They were just saying, hey, you know, you'll get more listeners. And I thought, okay, maybe.
We could put it on YouTube.
True.
Or we could get on radio or satellite. Hello, radio and satellite people.
Yes.
Call us. Call us, PRI. Now that Eirik last dissed you. But anyway, we'll get to that later.
Yes.
So SoundCloud.
You know, we've actually peppered a whole bunch of like little Easter eggs in this for all of the future. You know, we've kind of foreshadowed some of the stories we're discussing later.
That's exciting. All right. So SoundCloud, why are we talking about them?
Well, because what they did was they wanted to start to get into streaming. To do that, they had to sit down with the record companies. And the record company said, hey, by the way, you know you have a whole bunch of our music on your service that people have uploaded, third parties have uploaded, and we don't like that. We don't like having our catalog.
He doesn't mean artists. He means like just fans.
What do you mean? Well,
I mean, a lot of artists use SoundCloud and they post their stuff. Does Universal mean people are illegally taking music and posting it, or do they mean the artists themselves are posting it?
Both.
Well, because surely they don't object to the artist doing it.
Well, sometimes they do because the artist doesn't have permission to do it.
Okay.
So. All right.
So they're saying there's stuff up there we do not want to be on there.
Yes, and unfortunately, since there are tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of tracks, it's really hard to police.
Right. And you're like, we're just a platform. We don't police it. It's just up there. If someone puts it up, that's their fault.
And that's what the DMCA is for, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You could send a takedown notice to SoundCloud, and then they could investigate it and take it down, and somebody could counter, and there's a whole process to go through. YouTube has the same issues. And YouTube said, all right, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build like an automatic detection algorithm that detects copyrighted works and pulls them down. So you submit, you know,
even when they're not. Like when we try to post a trailer that a studio has provided. But anyway.
Yes. I mean, Michael and I, when we were in Cannes together, I think it was 2011, we did these little shorts that kind of explained what was going on at the festival. And we would cut away to footage, no audio, just footage of a film as we talked over it.
Provided by the studio.
Correct. Or the distributor. And we'd be talking over it about... 6 weeks later, it would be pulled down saying, oh, there's copyrighted material somewhere in this. There's video that is copyrighted material. They didn't look at what it was. They just kind of took it down.
It's automatic. So it doesn't always work great. And SoundCloud says, that sounds like a big pain in the neck.
Right. We don't want 70,000 takedown notices coming to us all at once, which is about how many takedown notices each one of these, you know, Googles and the YouTubes are receiving per week or per month. I can't remember what the...
Per hour.
Yeah. So they basically said, here, Universal, here are the keys. You just, like, take down anything you want. No,
wow.
No process. No, just, you know, if it's yours, just take it down.
Wow.
The problem is there are DJs that kind of use the music for mashups that are actually, you know, they have permission to use the music, or they go back and they purchase the rights for the stems, and they do these mashups and these mixes. And so some of these DJs had some of their music taken down, and they found out how this was done.
And well, that's not the only problem, right? The problem is that you shouldn't let Universal have control over what or what does not get posted on your website.
Well, that's the biggest problem here.
Yeah.
That is by far the biggest problem, and it caused this whole big kerfuffle.
And then the other label said, hey, how come we don't get the keys to the car? Why don't we get to decide what to put up and post down? I'm sure they would all want that, too.
They not only want the keys, they want to be sitting in the driver's seat.
What's happening?
They want to kick Universal into shotgun. You know,
happening?
So the, you know, SoundCloud came out with a statement that said, hey, you know, we're looking into it, and geez, you caught us. But, you know,
have they stopped it?
I don't know. No, it doesn't seem like they have.
Wow. Wow, that could really turn off the artists. I mean, whatever support they have, to my mind, is mostly from artists and DJs, not from the labels. So if they're just about to piss all them off, that's a really bad move.
Yes, I would agree.
And I guess it'll be a big deal.
Oh, I see where you were headed with that. Okay, yes, it is a big deal, which means it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the movie Frozen is coming to network TV, people.
What?
All right.
What? Oh, my God.
Yeah,
let it go.
Hey, whatever you do, do not sing the second line of that. Otherwise, we will be pulled down from anywhere we post this. Well, you know, actually, not quite. Frozen is not actually going to, you know, in a sign of genuine synergy, the character Elsa from the animated film Frozen will be coming to ABC's primetime fairy tale Once Upon a Time this season. With a major story arc, Georgina Haig from the CBS series Reckless landed the coveted part, with Elizabeth Lail playing her sister and Scott Michael Foster of the TV series Greek playing her love interest. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop. It's just a new character on Once Upon a Time, but it is actual synergy. My God, it does work sometimes. It does make sense. It'll probably bring a fair amount of little bump to the show, especially if it's a good storyline. And I'm very happy for Scott Michael Foster. That's good casting. He plays the Jonathan Groff character, I think, right? And he's a fun actor from Greek. He makes perfect sense in that part. So I hope that gives a little boost to his career.
Mon Dieu! How did you like my French there? Did you like that?
Très bien.
Okay, well, apparently Scarlett Johansson knows more about French law than we do. So
what?
She probably speaks it way better than both of us.
If she speaks it poorly, she speaks it way better than both of us.
That's true, actually. She won her case in French courts against an author who had a lead character in his novel that was confused by other characters in the novel, in the book, for being the movie star Johansson. And the first character, the lead character, took advantage of that. She won about $7,000, including court costs, though no damages. Author Grégoire Delacourt was bemused by the lawsuit over his bestseller, which has sold about 100,000 copies.
Wow.
Now his publisher says since the lawsuit has been settled, they're ready to make a deal in the U.S. Maybe Johansson would pose for the cover. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, but I'm so confused. Like, what did she win and why? And does this mean that they can still publish it in North America?
I have no
idea.
Does
she get to sue again? I don't think here she'd have a case. I mean, a character that people think is someone else, but it's not. I don't get it. But I wish I knew better about French law and someone could explain what was going on. But clearly, it was a moral victory, but not a big financial victory, since they were asking for like $80,000 in damages for some reason, and they got turned down. But Lindsay Lohan's doing the same thing, isn't she?
Yeah, I guess, I haven't played Grand Theft Auto 922 or whatever number they're up to now. It's Grand Theft Auto 5, actually. I guess there's a character in the game called Lacey Jonas.
I still can't figure Pac-Man out, so don't ask me.
Well, this character, Lacey Jonas, is a young starlet who the players rescue from pursuing a paparazzi. And a lot of people said, gosh, that seems just like Lindsay Lohan, since Jonas is a silky blonde, kind of like Miss Lohan. And
I thought she was a brunette.
Well, I think she changes her hair depending on, you know.
Oh, whatever.
The character in the game, she's got a line of clothing, kind of like Miss Lohan.
You mean she wears clothes like? You don't mean the character sells a line of clothing, do you? You mean she's dressed like what people think Lindsay Lohan is dressed like?
No, no, no. She has a line of clothing. And
the character's
has
a fashion line.
Yes.
Okay.
She also has a penchant for complaining about the difficulties of being a star.
You and I do that all the time.
And she kind of hangs out at the Chateau Marmont in West Hollywood, which is where, by the way, Lindsay Lohan has racked up a bill of $46,000 in the past.
But everybody, Chateau Marmont, I don't think that's a very good tie-in to her.
Either way.
You know, she's not known as the Chateau Marmont girl. You know, that's known where gazillion celebrities go.
Yes, although only John Belushi doesn't make it out.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's where he died. In any case, too soon. It's been like 35, 40 years. In any case, she's suing Take-Two Interactive and Rockstar Games for, I guess, impersonating Lindsay Lohan, impersonating her.
I don't know if she's made a good... She hasn't convinced me.
Okay.
I'll just say that. I don't know if she's convinced you. Sounds like it's probably not worth her time, but whatever.
What I would say, okay, this is... If the court rules in her favor, it's actually good for Lohan. It'll be the biggest hit the actress has ever had.
You mean because the movies made the video games made $800 million in its first day?
Yes, when it went on
sale.
That's
what you referred to. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Nice.
Ira Glass is parting ways with Public Radio International, the syndicator that has handled his iconic series for many years. Glass felt the show was handling so many duties on its own, namely the podcast version and other digital ventures, that it was worth exploring going out on their own. Even though, as authors and musicians will attest, companies handle a lot of boring, time-consuming stuff like billing and other backroom annoyances. Glass was courted heavily by National Public Radio, NPR, the distributor that most people think of as synonymous with public radio, but ultimately, they decided to go solo. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's a you know, earth-shaking change for public radio and what it means. The show will be on the same channels, the same networks, the same time. None of that's going to change for the audience, but it does send seismic shockwaves. I mean, he was turned into a big star. He's been very loyal. It's not like he bolted at the first opportunity, but still, it's got to scare people like PRI and NPR because this is where they make their money. Big shows that are long-lasting institutions, and to have him go solo, that's very scary.
Did I ever tell you when I worked at CAA, I called Ira Glass during his first year of This American Life?
And said you wanted to be his agent. Yeah, we mentioned that last time, I think.
Okay.
I just interrupted because I didn't want, you know.
You didn't want me to repeat the same story that I've told probably 12 times. Okay.
No, but perfectly well. And of course, it's still, you know, what will this mean for others? I think it means that PRI and NPR should be calling us. But anyway, by the way, also, I think we've mentioned before that Garrison Keillor talked about retiring, but apparently he's sort of retracted that. He's perfectly happy. He's doing his show. So at least they're not going to lose a Prairie Home Companion anytime soon.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, Michael. What gobbles up the most electricity in your home?
Mouth.
Okay. I didn't realize you plugged yourself in. But if you have air conditioning, okay, that's number one. But number two might surprise you. Is it your fridge? That's what I would go with. Your computer? I certainly hope not. But it is close. It's your cable box. The innocuous little buggers are gobbling up energy 24 hours a day, even when they're not, quote-unquote, on, and the TV isn't recording anything. They often use up to 35 watts every 30 days and can cost about $8 a month all on their own, just to run, not to rent from the cable company.
Right.
Since the cable companies don't pay the bills, they really don't care, despite years of lobbying by conservationists. Federal standards have driven down energy consumption of TVs and fridges by about 75% in recent years, even though the cost of the products has fallen too. The same will happen for cable boxes if cable companies are forced into acting. At the end of 2013, 11 cable companies agreed to start producing set-top boxes that used anywhere from 10% to 40% less energy, even though easy fixes would drive down their consumption much further. And of course, it's just for the new boxes, not swapping out the ones in people's homes that we all have right now. Until then, you can look at your sky-high cable bill and add another $10 per month to it in electricity. That's just what I love to do. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal, actually. You think about all the cable boxes in the country, that adds up a lot. And, you know, their deal was like, well, we'll lower it by 5% over the next 20 years. It's like so lame and pathetic. What do they care?
Is it the thought police or smart business? In either case, more artists have lost their jobs over allegations of impropriety or behavior on social media. First, the Cartoon Network fired Skylar Page, a.k.a. who? Creator of their hit series, Clarence.
Okay,
I don't know Skylar.
He's got a hit, neither do I, but he's got a successful show on Cartoon Network.
That's true. Now, the reason that they fired Skylar Page, a female coworker, Emily Partridge, accused him of sexual assault on Twitter. Now, when I first read that sentence, I thought, wait, was the sexual assault taking
place? No, she posted on Twitter that he had sexually assaulted her.
Variety said it was unclear where and when the assault took place. I had to read the next sentence to answer my question. Variety also claimed the police could find no record of a complaint being filed. On satellite radio, Anthony of the shock jock duo Opus and Anthony was fired by Sirius XM after an incident in Times Square. Late at night, Anthony Kumaya, I believe is how you pronounce his name, he was taking pictures in Times Square last week when one woman took offense, turned, and started yelling and hitting him. Anthony, who claims he was carrying a gun at the time, says he defended himself and deflected her blows but never struck back, even when he was surrounded by other people. The trouble for Anthony in terms of his job began when he started to post her face on Twitter and called her a savage and said things like they're taking over and decried the problems of violence in the black community.
Yeah, this woman was black, by the way.
Yeah. He was summarily fired from his job. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, both of these sort of make my head spin. We've talked a lot about the sexual allegations against some directors and top Hollywood executives. And now we've got this person, a person accused of sexual assault, and this guy making comments that people were offended by on Twitter. I don't understand what happened in both cases. I mean, they fired him because somebody posted on Twitter that he sexually assaulted them. I would take that very seriously, but did she, you know, go to the police? I mean, let things take their course. Maybe you would suspend them or take steps to make sure everybody was comfortable and that she didn't have to work with. Why would you fire someone because somebody alleged that they did something in a bizarre manner? Like, you don't post that on Twitter. You go to the police. Are they uncomfortable going to the, you know, I don't know what's going on. Did they file a complaint at work? Did they go to the police? I mean, proper steps need to be taken. Just because someone's accused doesn't mean they're guilty. Make sure everyone's comfortable. Make sure if you need to that they're suspended or kept separate from somebody that's horrible. You know, but like, does that make any sense to you at all?
No. I mean, usually when things like this happen, it's because the network wanted them gone in the first place. They just use this as an
excuse. Well, that doesn't make any sense because this guy voices and does the character and created the show that's a hit, and it's a pretty new show. So I don't think they wanted to bum rush him out the door, but you know, that's a pretty bad excuse. You're opening yourself up to a lawsuit if you fire somebody and claim it's because someone else posted on Twitter something that is an unproven allegation that wasn't handled through the proper channels. You're just begging to be sued, right?
I would imagine you are.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, I'm not, of course, suggesting that if he wasn't found guilty or, you know, I mean, but you got to let some things take their course and let, you know, it doesn't. And Anthony Kumaya, oh my God, a shock jock said offensive comments.
Yeah.
You know, really? And they fired him before like Monday, like the second it happened.
They fired, like I guess on Tuesday he sent out the Twitter posts, and then on like
Wednesday
Thursday or yeah, he was fired like the very next day.
Yeah, it seemed like it was before we hadn't even been back on the air yet. It just seemed very quick and summarily done, and that also seemed bizarre.
Especially, you know, since SiriusXM has the Opus and Anthony channel. This isn't just like one.
Yeah, and he constantly says things that are envelope pushing and offensive. And as he says, I didn't, you know, this woman attacks me physically in Times Square and I get fired. You know, I said things online, you took offense to them. I didn't say anything, as far as he's concerned, I didn't use any racist terms, such as, you know, the N-word or whatever. Other people would say you can't call a black person a savage and not realize that that's a racially loaded term. And there were other things that he said, like they're taking over, blah, 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 you know, that you can point to and say, look, in context, you're an idiot if you don't think that's going to be taken in a racial context. But the point is, whatever, this woman hit him in Times Square for doing something perfectly legal, and your shock jock made shock jocky type comments. I mean, if that was the standard, you'd think he'd be fired years ago.
Yeah.
Just both of these really make your head spin.
Yeah, especially since, you know, the comments weren't really widely dispersed. I mean, I didn't hear about these comments until he got fired. So congratulations. You've now actually given him more press than.
And obviously that doesn't mean we don't take allegations of sexual assault seriously. You immediately go, we need to have an internal investigation and you need to go to the police.
Yeah, those are the two you things know, you need like, to do.
Yeah. All right.
Librarians gathered in Las Vegas in strong numbers last week. Their annual convention included electing the first Gen Xer to become its new president. Oh my God, we're old enough to be presidents of librarian. Oh gosh.
I didn't even know Gen Xer was a term still used.
And neither did I. Well, they also gave out the Carnegie Medal to adult authors Donna Tartt and Doris Kearns Goodwin. And of course, they debated ebooks, publishers, and what to do next. All top publishers now offer ebooks to libraries in some form or another, but the experience for users can be frustrating, and the challenges for librarians, which include archiving books and whether to emphasize new books or catalog and so on, well, all those challenges are enormous. Meanwhile, a list from Nielsen, gotta love those guys, they show the best-selling books of 2014 so far appear to be young adult novels like John Green's The Fault in Our Stars and Veronica Roth's Divergent. Apparently anything that's been turned into a movie is a bestseller now. While the best-selling nonfiction ebook was Solomon Northrup's 1853 autobiography, 12 Years a Slave. I guess I was right about my previous comment. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's just an annual convention. It's great that they did. The Carnegie Medal is a very prestigious award for children's books, and they're finally giving one out for adults as well. So that's cool to see. I think it's a good, reasonable extension of that brand. I think it will be very meaningful to authors, and hopefully it'll help their sales, just like the Carnegie Medal has for kids. Donna Tartt got it for The Goldfinch, of course, and Doris Kearns Goodwin for Bully Pulpit. And most of all, though, Solomon Northrup's book, 12 Years a Slave, that's the best-selling nonfiction ebook so far this year. That's unbelievable.
Especially
that book is available for free.
I was going to say, it should be available for $0 over
at
Gutenberg.
I got it for $0. It's totally available. So if you provide value and context and a forward and afterward and good annotation and it's well-formatted, you can get value out of that. I'm sure they didn't sell it for – I imagine this is best-selling ebook as in units. I don't imagine it's dollar amount. But still, that's kind of amazing and tells you, even with all these free books that are available, there's a lot of money that can be made.
That's true. Now, are you a fan of The Goldfinch? Donna Tartt's big best-selling, everybody's talking about a book?
I finally just read her first novel, which is called?
I Can't Remember. And it's not called I Can't Remember. I really can't remember.
It's called The Secret History. Okay. It's from 1992. That was a huge bestseller out of nowhere. And a friend of mine, it was one of his favorite books. And he was aghast that I hadn't read it. And so I read it without telling him because I was afraid, what if I don't like it? But I liked it. It was very good. So
that was written in 1992?
That's right. 22 years ago.
Okay.
That's when it was published, I should say.
Wow.
So she's had two books since then. I think her second one most people thought was not quite as good, but she's still an interesting talent. And now this book has been very successful. I look forward to reading it soon.
Okay. Well, we know that the journalists and top people implicated in the News of the World phone hacking scandal were morally corrupt and had broken journalistic standards. We've already talked about that. But when Rebecca Brooks was found not guilty, it seemed perhaps the legal line they crossed was a bit gray or the charges were too difficult to prove. Not anymore, no longer. Andy Coulson, the former spokesperson for the UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown, he was sentenced to 18 months in prison, along with four others on trial receiving jail time and other punishments. Coulson and others face new trials on a number of other charges, and Rupert Murdoch is being called in for questioning by Scotland Yard. So perhaps preying on the misery of bereaved family members, of missing children and dead people wasn't so clever? I don't know. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because they broke the law and they deserve to be punished. And I'm glad because they were, you know, making hay off the misery of others in a shoddy journalistic practice. So, you know, there was that day of headlines for Rebecca Brooks that made it seem like, aha, they were exonerated or they got off scot-free. That's clearly not the case.
You may have won an Oscar, but you don't own that Oscar.
Wait a second. Is this like that? Is this a digital Oscar? Is this like, you know, buying an album or book online? We're like, yeah, you got that digital album, but it's not actually yours.
You're just licensing it. You're licensing your Oscar.
That's right.
The heirs of Oscar winner Joseph Wright sold his statuette for the movie My Gal Sal at auction for almost $80,000. Not so fast, says the Academy, since winners agree they must first offer to sell back a statuette for $10. Not so fast, says the family, which points out those agreements began in 1951. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
A big whoop. It's kind of interesting and cute, but yeah, it's one of those, the Oscars before the early 50s are all sort of in this nebulous gray area as far as what you're allowed to do with them. I understand the Academy's desire to not let them be bartered and sold online in the world, but you know, sorry, you didn't think of it back then.
You know, it's never easy to make a feature film, especially when your director needs assurances that the country they'll be filming in won't extradite him on statutory rape charges.
You got to do everything when you work on a movie, don't you?
Yeah.
Producers got to handle everything. Where am I going to get the cocaine from?
Oh, brother. Well, that's what's going on now. That's the case with Oscar winner Roman Polanski. I guess he still has his Oscar. His new film is about the famed French Dreyfus affair, based on the novel An Officer and a Spy by Robert Harris. He wants to film entirely in Poland, which would make it his first film to shoot entirely in his home country since Knife in the Water back in 1962. Polanski has dual French and Polish citizenship, and Poland wants to make this film happen. The only issue is the legality of ignoring their extradition treaty with the U.S. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's interesting. They'll perhaps find some place where they can film it. He's made movies all these years. I'm sure they'll figure something out. I actually read the book. It just came out a few months ago, and it was actually pretty good. It's a novel, and it focuses on a French officer who's sort of investigating the issue around Dreyfus and whether there's any truth to it, even though he's already been jailed, and he becomes convinced of his innocence, even though he doesn't like Jews. So it's kind of, you know, he doesn't do it because he loves Dreyfus or wants to defend him, but he just feels honor bound to go where the facts lead him, and that makes him, you know, persona non grata for a lot of other people. They wanted him to just sweep things under the rug. So it's sort of an interesting side angle onto the Dreyfus affair. That Dreyfus himself would be sort of boring because he sits in jail and acts noble. You know, this is sort of a more interesting, compelling tale, and it could make a good movie.
I don't know what Richard Dreyfuss has to do with this movie.
He could play Dreyfuss. I think he did play Dreyfuss, now that I say that.
Well, just around the same time that Monty Python gave a series of farewell concerts, The Rock...
Every sperm is sacred. Oh, sorry.
This is, I think, what people mean by interrupting. I'm just, you know, I'm going out on a limb. The rock band The Who are planning to do the same. And to that, I would say, who? No, just kidding. Of course, they've been giving farewell tours for seemingly decades now. The first one I remember was in 1983. It was a big deal.
Wow, really?
Yes. This time they plan on recording a new album and doing a big old rock stadium tour for the last time. Sure, they might play smaller venues in the future and so on, but this would be their last big hurrah, followed by lots of smaller hurrahs, I suppose. Hey, it's better than waiting for Led Zeppelin to get back together. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's definitely a big whoop. It's our annual goodbye tour. You know,
yes.
It's as big whoopy as it gets. But I'd be happy to see them. I liked
what Pete Townsend had to say. He said, "We are what we are and extremely good at it, but we're lucky to be alive and still touring. If I had enough hairs to split, I'd say that for 13 years since 1964, The Who didn't really exist. So we are really only 37, not 50.
So I am wrong. I believe, Richard Dreyfuss played,
You're going backstory? Okay.
Colonel Picard in a TV movie called Prisoner of Honor from 1991. I think it was a TV movie. It's Ken Russell directed it. So it was a feature film, and it was about the Dreyfus affair. And he played Richard Dreyfus, I should say, played this man who had to. Oh no, this is the same story. It is the same story. Picard may be the name of the character in the novel I read. It's the colonel who's supposed to justify his sentence, and he ends up deciding he was a scapegoat. And so his attempt to prove right this wrong ends his military career. And there you go. That's very interesting. So yeah, this is a remake of a movie, and he played the lead role, but not Dreyfus, but Colonel Picard.
If you're confused by any of this, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Should I say it all again?
No.
No.
No, not at all.
Sorry. No. Anyway.
We were talking about The Who and their little, you know, the long goodbye tour. Did you see this viral video of the Rolling Stones talking about Monty Python? Monty Python commissioned the Rolling Stones to do this little...
No, I didn't.
It was Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts. Mick Jagger sitting on a couch and Charlie Watts is sitting next to him. And an assistant comes in and says, "Hey, what would you like to do? You know, what do you want on the set list for tomorrow? What songs?" And I guess he's like, "Monty Python's on tour? They're doing these shows. Monty..." Mick Jagger keeps talking about Monty Python on these. She's like, why would anybody want to see that? I mean, it was funny in the 60s, but, you know, why would anybody want to see that now? It's just a bunch of wrinkled old men trying to relive their youth for a bunch of money. And the assistant says, "Well, what about the set list?" He's like, "Well, let's give the people what they want. How about some,
Start Me Up.
Yeah, let's open with, and maybe throw in some Satisfaction." It's very funny.
That's cool. I'll have to check it out.
Well, Michael, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week, how will this affect our audience? Well, it may not, and that's a good thing. We're going to be joined by Jonathan Handel, who is an attorney focused on entertainment and technology law at Troy Gould in Los Angeles and independently. He is also a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. His most recent book on the entertainment industry is The New Zealand Hobbit Crisis, which tells the story of an attempt to unionize actors on The Hobbit. When I first read that title, I thought, oh my goodness,
Running out of hobbits.
They're either running out of hobbits or being overrun by hobbits in New Zealand. Jonathan, thank you for taking the time to join us.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Thank you.
Now, I guess the reason we wanted to speak with you, besides the fact that it's been so long since we last spoke with you, was there was some big news right on our 4th of July holiday weekend here that SAG and AFTRA, which have now combined, so the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio...
Artists.
Yes. They combined a couple years ago, and they reached a new contract, some new contract terms and a new deal with the AMPTP, the Producers Guild. Actually, it's not the Producers Guild. It's since the PGA is something else now, but it's basically the studios and the networks. What exactly did they, what agreement did they come to?
Well, that's right. They, so these agreements, the master agreements covering television and motion pictures run for 3-year terms. They expire every 3 years. And, this is the year. Now the Directors Guild and the Writers Guild already did their deals. The DGA, in fact, did their deal about six, 7 months ago. Even though their agreement only expired, it didn't expire until June 30th, just a few days ago, just last week. The way it tends to work in the entertainment industry is that the first union to do a deal during a negotiating cycle, and these days it's frequently the first union is the DGA, because they like to go early, sets a pattern. And the other unions tend to do deals that reflect that pattern, at least insofar as the pattern, you know, with regard to things that relate across unions.
So basically you have like the studios or the AMPTP turning to whoever the second and third unions are, saying, well, we didn't give that to the directors, or we gave this to the writers, and so you'll have to take that same type of deal.
You know, in essence, yes, but it turns out that because these negotiations are kind of a kabuki dance, a stylized set of moves and counter moves, that frequently the second and third union has to fight to get the same thing that the first union got. So the studios will probably offer something a little bit less in certain ways, and the second and third union will demand something a little bit more. But everyone knows, for example, that because the DGA got basically 3% annual wage increases when they did their deal back in October, November, that the Writers Guild was going to get the same thing, and that the Screen Actors Guild, or the SAG-AFTRA, was going to get the same thing.
Well, now, this deal is the first one since they merged, and they said, we need to merge because then we'll have more power in negotiating. So what is different about this deal? Do you see any indication of them having a newfound power with the enlarged unions that they have combined together for television and film? And, you know, what was the result of that?
Well, probably yes. But to see where that comes in, you have to look at the fact that each of these unions also have issues that are specific to that union. Writers Guild, they didn't just get what the DGA got. They also had some issues that related specifically to writers about exclusivity and holds for television writers.
Right, and we kind of talked a little bit about that on a past episode, where when a television show was produced, if you were waiting to see whether the show was picked up or not, the writer was on hold and couldn't work.
Right, couldn't work, but also wasn't getting paid.
Right.
Exactly. So that was a big issue for the writers. Now, so what was the big issue for SAG-AFTRA besides what was in the template? And I guess we should say it might be good to say what was in the DGA template, because there was a lot there. There were these annual wage increases. There were new terms regarding minimums, but also especially residuals for programs on services like Netflix, high-budget streaming video on demand, so Netflix, Amazon Prime, and so forth. And there were some improvements in some of the existing new media residuals formulas. So the Writers Guild got that also, and so did SAG-AFTRA. But the big issue for SAG-AFTRA that was unique to them was, even though the unions merged 2 years ago, as you as you alluded to, the contracts were not merged. This was the first negotiation with the merged union, and this was the first negotiation where they said, look, we have separate television agreements from SAG and from AFTRA. We want to merge those agreements. We need to do something about wage rates because there were different wage rates in those agreements. We need to do something to make it easier to merge our health and ultimately pension plans because those plans are legally separate and there is still a separate SAG plan and a separate AFTRA plan. So that was the big agenda item, you know, that was unique to SAG-AFTRA.
But, and they got the higher formula for their payment when they chose between SAG and AFTRA and negotiated, they were able to negotiate and achieve the higher residual rate, the higher pay scale rate that they had in one contract versus the other.
No.
So the people who had a lower one, I thought they went up.
Yeah, no, they didn't. And that's an aspect of the agreement that's you know, that's going to be somewhat controversial. We've seen some pushback. What they managed to get was that the SAG television agreements prevailed. So on the one hand, that meant a lower rate for primetime as the base rate for new programs. Doesn't affect existing programs. So existing shows that are under the higher AFTRA rate will continue to be under the AFTRA contract, but for new shows going forward. But what they also got on the plus side for the union was that basic cable was an area where SAG and AFTRA were not in as strong a position as the other unions. The other unions had industry-wide basic cable contracts. SAG and AFTRA had sort of supplemental agreements that were signed on a one-off basis. And the AFTRA agreement often paid less residuals or no residuals at all because it used a different formula than the SAG basic cable agreement. The AFTRA agreement, there actually were several different ones. It's sort of complicated, but the SAG one was the better of the two and was the one that really matched the way the other unions do it.
Well, in writing about this new contract for the Hollywood Reporter, you say that what this means is that the basic cable terms will reflect the quote-unquote Sanchez residuals formula used in the SAG, DGA, and WGA agreements rather than after his quote-unquote exhibition day approach, to which I said, no, not Sanchez. What is Sanchez? I had no idea, actually.
Okay. Sanchez is the name of a residuals formula. Residuals, you know, differ. There are tons of different formulas for calculating residuals. It depends on what was something made for in the first instance. Like, it was a movie? Was it made for broadcast? Was it made for HBO? And where is it being reused? Is it being reused on broadcast or DVD or the internet, et cetera? When a basic cable show reruns on basic cable, the formula that the DGA uses is referred to as Sanchez, because that was the first show, Sanchez of Bel Air, decades ago, that implemented this formula.
What show?
Sanchez of Bel Air. I didn't realize that's where they took the name from. I know about the differing residual kind of platforms or scales, but I had no idea that it was referred to as Sanchez.
I thought it was the person watching the show.
No, this one is Sanchez, and then the Writers Guild, there's a choice of Sanchez, which I think is the predominant one, but there is a choice of another one referred to as Hitchcock, because the first show there was the remake of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. So, you know, these contracts are like sort of like roach motels. I mean, contract clauses check in, but they don't check out. They have this history to them. And these are these formulas that are, you know, several decades old now. Sanchez is the DGA formula. It's basically the more common, I think, of the Writers Guild formulas. It's the formula that SAG had. And AFTRA, on the other hand, had a choice of Sanchez or this exhibition day approach. And, you know, the detail of exactly how the formula works, it's a percentage. You get lost in the weeds, really. You know, I've done a color chart you've probably seen that tries to summarize the entire residual system in a single page. And backstage, when I first came out with the chart, said that it looked like the periodic table of elements on mushrooms.
It does, actually. We've linked to it in the past, and it always changes. But I guess, speaking of changing, over the weekend I was speaking to somebody who produces a show for Comedy Central, which started out online, and they still have an online portion. And this producer was telling me that the complicated process of negotiating contracts for new media versus television how has new media been affected by all of this? Because, you know, how do they track that? For instance, I'm watching Alpha House on Amazon Prime, but that will never see money that I can think of. It'll never see money from being syndicated. I don't think it'll be sold on DVD. So the residuals to that seem, well, not all that important.
Well, the residuals for new media are, I would say, are small but growing. The Writers Guild just came out with their annual report, and they break things down in more detail than the other unions do, you know, publicly. These are still small potatoes compared to other media, but you know, and especially when you're talking about something that's made for new media in the first instance, like, you know, like Alpha House. But there are residuals. There is a formula. And, you know, I'd have to refer to my chart.
Back to the chart.
Back to the chart to remember offhand what it is. But, you know, there is a formula for almost everything in the residual system. And one of the key things is, as I say, that in this round of negotiations, that the new media formulas were improved, from the talent standpoint.
Well, that historically, we've seen that whenever there's a new media, the big companies will say, oh, my gosh, we want to do this compact disc, but we're spending so much money to launch it. We really can't pay you the same royalty that we do for LPs. You're really going to have to take a cut. You got to help us out here. And then they do the same thing with DVDs and VHS and any new media. They say, oh, we're not going to make any money on this. It's a nightmare. Please, you're just going to have to cut your royalty. So they obviously have probably tried to do the same thing with online and streaming and all this stuff. Are the unions having any success in saying, no, this is where the money is going to be. We need to make sure we are not losing ground because this is where you're making money now. And we need to be a part of that.
Well, as I say, they're having some success at that because the DGA template does improve the formulas in both ad-supported new media, you know, like when something runs on a broadcast show runs on Hulu, and in, made for high-budget SVOD.
And that an example of that would be House of Cards or Orange is the New Black.
Right.
So looking back, you saw nobody wanted a strike. Nobody on either side was in the mood for a strike. They wanted to make a deal. Money is slipping away from DVD, but it's coming up on digital downloads and streaming. Do you feel like everybody worked together well and things are progressing positive for everyone? Is that the overall big picture here?
Well, I'd say that it is, but the caveat and the difficulty for the unions is that, it really relates to your previous question, is that although they've improved the new media formulas lately, the money in new media still is a lot less than it is in broadcast. Take a concrete example. Shows used to, a primetime show used to rerun on primetime later in the season or especially during the summer. And under the residuals formula, that was a very lucrative rerun for talent.
Right.
Residual was very large. These days, instead, what happens is the episode runs reruns on Hulu or on another ad-supported internet platform. And even with the improvements in the formula that the DGA made, that residual is much, much lower, like a seventh or a tenth size.
Oh wow, that's much smaller. You're right.
Yeah, it's a major hit. So, it's now the studios will say, and networks will say, well, but we make less money. Ad rates are lower and blah blah blah.
But they own a piece of Hulu. They own the company that's showing it, so they make money on the ads, and they own the value of the company that's showing the stuff.
That's right. I mean, in the last 20 years, the amount of interconnection between media companies. I mean, 20 years ago, the networks and studios were separate companies. Now they all own each other, whether it's a network owning a studio or vice versa. They own at least some of the online platforms. Hulu is the most prominent example. And so the sort of Watergate maximum, of follow the money becomes, infinitely more difficult when everything's connected like an octopus.
You know, we mentioned Sanchez and Exhibition Day. I'm wondering when the Wasserman Clause will come into effect. Lou Wasserman ran Universal, speaking of studios, and he was famous for hating these residuals and saying, you know, when a plumber comes to install a toilet, do I have to pay him every time I flush the toilet? Why can't I just create a product, make a product, pay the people that made the product for me, and then it's mine and I can market it? Residuals aren't going away anytime soon, it seems.
No, they're not. I mean, you know, to give a sense of how important economically residuals are, entertainment residuals, you know, in aggregate are annually about $2 billion. So it's a lot of money. For actors, residuals comprise roughly 40% of their annual income. For writers, I think the figure is something like 35-ish or 30-ish or something like that. And directors, I don't have figures on that, but they'd probably be, you know, slightly less than for writers, you know, just because people get, you know, directors get paid more upfront typically than a lot of actors do, for example, or writers. So, you know, but bottom line, I mean, this is a huge amount of money, both in aggregate and in terms of its importance to rank and file union members.
To eating. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the money that people survive on between gigs. So, you know, is this going to go away all of a sudden? You know, no. The concern that the unions have at a large level is, though, that are things going to shift to residuals formulas, to platforms where the residuals formulas are less lucrative?
Yes, they are. And finally, the big headline was perhaps that they finally came up with a basic cable agreement incorporated into an industry-wide agreement for the first time. For the first time, they actually had an agreement for all of basic cable. I guess in the past, everything was catch-as-catch-can on a singular basis. I'm not sure what was going on before, but it's been 40 years for basic cable. What the heck took so long?
Well, shows made for basic cable, it's a little less than 40 years, but yeah, it has been, it's been several decades. And, you know, that was, I think, probably it was an example of where when you had two separate actors unions, they just didn't have the leverage to push for this. Because, you know, as I say, the Writers Guild, their industry-wide agreement has basic cable in it and has for many years. Likewise with the Directors Guild. It was only SAG and AFTRA where you had these standalone sort of supplemental agreements that were entered into on a show-by-show basis. So that is an important gain for them. And the fact that they've got, you know, they got the better of the formulas is important as well.
Whenever it comes to contracts and specifically these union contracts, it all gets very, very complicated. And it's always great to have you, Jonathan Handel. Again, you're an attorney and a lawyer working in entertainment and technology law at Troy Gould. You're also a contributing editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and kind of walk us through this new agreement with SAG-AFTRA and the AMPTP. We're going to place a link to your work in the Hollywood Reporter in our show notes, but is there anything else we should be plugging?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is jhandel.com, jhandel.com.
We'll also place a link to that in the show notes as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was good of him to join us. I looked up Sanchez of Bel-Air. It's a TV show, a sitcom from 1986. It aired on the USA Network, and I think it was a Chicano version of the Jeffersons. They were an East LA family that made it good, and they moved to Bel-Air, and hilarity ensued. I don't recognize a lot of the stars. Richard Coca, Alitza, I'm not sure they are, but Bobby Sherman, the teen idol, was also on the show. So there you go, kind of interesting.
Well, it's always good to speak with Jonathan Handel, and we're just talking about how we hadn't had him on the show in ages, and sure enough, here we are with a perfect reason to speak with him.
Absolutely.
Now, we did get some listener email from Greg Bridle, and you may recall, Michael, last week you said, you know, just kind of jokingly that you were at the University of Yoo-Hoo or something like that. Because
I forgot about that. The Yoo-Hoo Institute. I wanted to get some free Yoo-Hoo, which is America's favorite chocolate soft drink.
Right. He writes, "Hi guys, just in case you haven't been told, I highly recommend not ordering Yoo-Hoo in either Europe or Oceania, as in those regions, it's an adhesive, albeit spelled differently. Not the best option for a refreshing beverage." Greg Bridle. Now,
See, I drank the Yoo-Hoo and it was actually glue. It's like a crazy glue, it looks like.
Yeah, actually it's, we have the same glue here. It comes in glue sticks as well.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yoo-hoo. It's UHU, the all-purpose adhesive. Maybe we'll get a box of that soon.
Yes. Which could actually work since somebody... No, I'm just kidding. But
yes. So it keep me from interrupting. Is that what you're saying, Sperling? I was better this week.
Well, guess what? You'll have 2 weeks to practice since we will be off the next 2 weeks. I'm traveling and...
Your fault.
It is my fault, but we will be trying to upgrade the website a little bit. So the next 2 weeks, there will not be a show. We'll be back in 3 weeks. In the meantime, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher. We do urge you to subscribe to the show and to rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, that's where you can find us. Please subscribe, rate, and review. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show, or you can follow us on Twitter. At showbizsandbox is our username. You can like us on Facebook. What is it? Facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That's where you can like us. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or like Greg Bridle, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and something different. This week, Michael, what is it?
Jacques.com.
Ah, I see. You're relating that back to the French...
The Dreyfus Affair. That's right. The Emile Zola letter.
Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry and theater and books there, try the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until 3 weeks from now, play nice.